Welcome to Stick Like Glue Radio, the only podcast dedicated to helping you create an everlasting bond with your customers so they stay longer, spend more, and refer more. Marketing and business building expert Jim Palmer, known internationally as the Newsletter Guru, is a serial entrepreneur, author, speaker, and coach to other entrepreneurs. Jim is the host of Newsletter Guru TV, a weekly web TV show featuring Jim's unique brand of smart marketing and business building advice. Check it out today at www.newsletterguru.tv. Please welcome your host of Stick Like Glue Radio, Jim Palmer.
Well, hello there, everybody. Welcome to Stick Like Glue Radio, the only podcast dedicated to helping you create an everlasting bond with your customers so they stay longer, spend more, and refer more, and those are all great things in your business. I'm your host, Jim Palmer, and I'm committed to helping you build a more profitable business faster. I am just so very excited about this week's show because my very special, most awesome guest is not only a great friend of mine, truly one of the nicest people on the planet, and his name is Mr. Bob Berg. So let me tell you a little bit about my great friend, Bob. I'm actually start off this intro with a question for you all in the listening audience. Can you really systematically and consistently get the results you want from others while making them feel generally good about themselves, about the process, and about you? Well, our guest, Bob, says, absolutely, yes, you can. So Bob Berg is a much sought-after speaker at corporate conferences and for entrepreneurial events. He regularly addresses audience ranging in size from 50 to 16,000. He's shared the platform with notables, including today's top thought leaders, broadcast personalities, Olympic athletes, and political leaders, including a former president of the United States. Although for years he was best known for his book, Endless Referrals, which is an outstanding book and a must-read, over the past few years it's really been his business parable, The Go-Giver, which he co-authored with the great writer John David Mann, which has captured the heart and imaginations of literally tens of thousands of readers. It shot to number 6 on the Wall Street Journal's Business Bestsellers list just 3 weeks after its release and reached number 9 on Business Week's. And since its release, it has consistently stayed in the top 25 on 800 CEO Reads Business Book Seller List. It's been translated into 21 different languages. It is his fourth book to sell over 250,000 copies. Holy smokes, that's amazing, and what an accomplishment. Now, Bob believes his new book, Adversaries into Allies, Win People Over Without Manipulation or Coercion, is by far his most important work, and I have to say, because I finished reading it literally about 2 weeks ago, and I couldn't agree more. Bob is an advocate, a supporter and defender of the free enterprise system, believing that the money one makes is directly proportional to how many people they serve. Love the word serve. He is also an unapologetic animal fanatic, and as I said, he's truly one of the kindest people I've ever met, and I'm just really thrilled, honored to have him as our guest expert today. Bob, how are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing great, Jim. Thanks for having me on, and big congratulations to you for your book, Stop Waiting for It to Get Easier. It's a huge success, and I'm going through it, and I just absolutely love it.
I appreciate that. It is just like you. I think this is my best book. They seem to be getting better every time we do it, so it's kind of exciting to see what comes out next, although I have no plans to write another one right now.
Me neither.
It's like you got to let it wear off. Anyway, your book, Adversaries into Allies, I love the title, by the way, but Bob, are you actually saying that everyone and anyone who in any way disagrees with you is your enemy?
That's a great question, and the answer is no, absolutely not. When we say adversary in this context, Jim, we're really just talking about someone who, even unintentionally, and just because of the context of the situation, may be standing in the way of your satisfaction. It might be the customer service representative who's not making it easy for you to return something. It may be the person, the gatekeeper, if you will, who's not allowing you access to his or her boss. It might be a spouse or family member who's in some way not being easy to get along with, or it could be anything else. But really, no, we're simply using that as sort of a a way to say that in life sometimes we need to be able to work with people in a way that we are really able to get the satisfaction that we want, that we're able to get the results we want, while still being able to make that person feel genuinely good about themselves, good about the situation, good about you. And so that's really the key aspect of the book. And I liken it in a way to Sada Haruo, the famous Japanese home run hitter. They used to call him the Japanese Babe Ruth, who considered the pitcher, rather than being his adversary, to be his partner in hitting home runs.
Very cool. You know, one thing that occurred to me, I mean, you're best known in the business world, but I was reading this book and, you know, I've been married 33 years and you know, I've learned a thing or two about what not to say, but your book really, I mean, it's really a great book for communicating and communication across the spectrum. I mean, home life, you know, again, like you say, whether you're going to go return something at Target or wherever, or in your business life, it really teaches you a lot. I found some really good little reminders as well as new strategies about just how to really have a great conversation so both people feel important, listened to, and, you know, and healthy in the relationship.
Well, thank you. And I think, like anything else, it's really about shifting your focus, moving from an I focus or me focus to an other focus, and looking at how what you want to accomplish ties into the goals, into the wants, the needs, and desires of the other person. And to the degree that we can keep that other person at the forefront, that's really the degree we're going to be influential.
Yeah, and speaking of influential, you know, you and I hang out in the marketing world a lot, in the business world. We hear the word influence. Mm-hmm. It's used a lot, and I've actually spotted it many times, you know, throughout your book. What do you think, what really is influence, Bob, and kind of why is it so important, do you think?
Well, on a very basic level, I define influence as simply the ability to move a person or persons to a desired action, usually within the context of a specific goal. On a bit deeper level, we could say that influence is an unseen flow of power. And I think both of those definitions work, but I don't think either one really captures the essence of influence. Influence is really about pull. You know, you don't hear people say, wow, that Jim Palmer, he is so influential. He has a lot of push with people. But you would hear he has a lot of pull. Why? Well, pull, you know, obviously is the opposite of push. It's difficult to push a rope. Pull is really a very legitimate form of power. Push, on the other hand, has more to do with compliance. It has more to do with manipulation. It has more to do with pressure. And, you know, when you do that, people really don't feel good about you. They don't feel good about themselves. They don't feel good about the situation. Often that kind of influence, if you will, because there can be negative influence, and that kind of influence that's based on push, you know, it may elicit a sense of compliance, but not commitment. And the challenge with that as a leader, as a marketer, as a salesperson, what have you, is that when you try to move people that way, at best, they're going to do exactly what they're told and not one bit more. And that's at best. At worst, they're going to find a way to sabotage the process completely. The opposite of compliance, of course, is commitment. And when you've got commitment, that's a whole different story. And I believe that this commitment is pretty much always the result of the influencer, and you could say the leader, but the influencer, not only understanding, but really embracing Dale Carnegie's famous admonition in his classic How to Win Friends and Influence People, where he wrote, ultimately, people do things for their reasons, not our reasons. So the great influencer, Jim, constantly questions themselves. You know, how does what I'm asking this person to do, how does that align with their wants, their needs, their desires, their goals? How does what I'm asking this other human being to do, how does that align with their values? And when asking ourselves these questions intelligently and genuinely, not in a way to manipulate another person to, you know, for our ends, but as a way to help and build another person, we've gone a long way toward earning that commitment, and there's a huge difference in the results of commitment and compliance. A great friend of mine, a terrific speaker and author on leadership and influence, her name is Dondi Scumaci. I think you know Dondi. And she says, and I absolutely love this, she says, compliance will never take you where commitment can go. Compliance will never take you where commitment can go. And great leaders, great influencers accomplish great things with others, but they always know that it comes back to the fact that really it's never about you. It's always about that other person. It's always about those people whose lives you choose to touch with the value that you provide. And again, and as you said, this could be a family member, it could be a friend, it could be an employee, an employer, a coworker, it could be the supplier, the committee member, or it could be that customer service person or that bureaucrat who's, you know, wanting us to fill out five forms when one will be enough. So the people who can do this, who can win people over, who can attain satisfaction, you know, that's the person who is influential, who can move people in a positive way that benefits everyone concerned.
Yeah, and I like how you talk about thinking, you know, what is it for the other person? How can I help them, and what are their needs and desires? I think I've believed for a long time, in the last couple of years especially, we've become so busy and so short on time that I think thinking about the other person has really taken a back seat. So hopefully we can get back to some civility there. But I know you also claim, Bob, that there's a difference between persuasion and manipulation. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, and that's a great question too, Jim. And years ago, when I first started to even talk about this topic, and I would call it positive persuasion, and people say, well, what's the difference between persuasion and manipulation? Because, hey, let's face it, they're cousins. They're both based on understanding how or what motivates human beings. And I say one's a good cousin, one's the evil cousin. Persuasion's good, but manipulation's bad. But why? And when I'd be asked that question, while I intuitively understood the difference, I never really explained it very well. And I'm a big believer that and this is not something I made up, but I believe it, that if you can't explain something and explain it simply, you probably don't understand it as well as you think you do. So I sort of went on a mission to really understand and be able to explain the difference. And I read a book years ago, and the book was written in 1987, I think, by a Dr. Paul W. Sweats. And the name of the book was The Art of Talking So That People Will Listen. But it was really much more about listening than it was about talking. And it was a brilliant, brilliant book. And in this book, Dr. Sweats provided what I thought was an absolutely brilliant difference between the two. And according to Dr. Sweats, manipulation aims at control, not cooperation. It does not consider the good of the other party. It tends to result in a win-lose situation. Now, totally opposite from the manipulator, the persuader always seeks to enhance the self-esteem of the other party. As a result, people respond better because they're treated as responsible, self-directing individuals. So I see the big difference in the two as being intent. But it's not just intent. It's also results. Because the manipulator may get instant results, and a persuader will too, okay? But the manipulator will have a lot of kickback to that. The manipulator will have people who will try to sabotage the process. They will rescind on the sale. They will, you know, again, sabotage the process if that's what happens. So a manipulator may not want to hurt another person, but they don't necessarily care if they do, as long as they get what they want. And as such, a manipulator can have employees, but really not a team of loyal, of loyal men. A manipulator can make a sale, but very rarely have happy, loyal customers who are their personal walking ambassadors, singing their praises to others and getting the referrals that you so expertly talk about. A manipulator can have a family, and a family who they love and who loves them, but rarely are the relationships functional. And, you know, so being a manipulator not only is bad as far as just living a life that way, it's not good business either. It's much better to be a persuader, because the persuader is not to do something for themselves without making sure the other person at best also wins, and at worst at least feels good about the situation.
Yeah. Hey, Bob, in your book you talk a lot about, which by the way is called Adversaries into Allies, again, a really, really wonderful book. You talk about the five principles of ultimate influence. Can you talk about those?
Sure. The principles themselves are control your own emotions, understand the clash of belief systems, acknowledge their ego, set the proper frame, and communicate with tact and empathy. And if you'd like, I can do a Reader's Digest version of each one of them, and then
would love it.
We can talk about different points regarding each.
Right.
Well, control your own emotions is really where it all begins. And I start the book with a saying from the sages, who is mighty? And the answer is that person who can control their own emotions and make of an enemy or of a potential enemy a friend. And again, this is where it starts, because only when you can control your own emotions, only when you're the boss of yourself, are you really in a position where you can take a potentially negative situation and turn it into a win for everyone involved. As human beings, we are emotional creatures. Now, we're logical to a certain point, but we're very emotional. And you're in sales and marketing. We make decisions emotionally, and we back up those decisions with logic. As human beings, we rationalize, which if you take the word rationalize, it simply means we tell ourselves rational lies. And so what that means really is our emotions control many of us. And obviously, when your emotions are in control of you, it's not a productive situation. Now, this does not mean in any way, shape, or form that I'm suggesting we become unemotional robots. Not at all. Emotions are a great part of life. They make life fun. But we need to be in control of them. Again, referring back to our friend Dondi Scumaci, she says, hey, take your emotions along for the ride, but make sure you're in the driver's seat and they're in the passenger side. And that's very key. Zig Ziglar, the great late Zig Ziglar, used to say, and I love this, he used to say it's the difference between reacting and responding. When you react, you're letting outside circumstances or people control you. When you respond, you're in control of yourself. And as such, you're then in control of the situation, and only then can something positive take place. So the first thing we need to do is make sure we are in control of our emotions. When someone, and we know that no one can make us mad, make us angry, make us sad, make us this or make us anything else, but hey, they can sure do things that push our buttons. And so we've got to prepare for that, and we've got to, and I provide some exercises in the book to do that, so that when it happens that you're in a situation in which you're kind of caught off guard and your emotions begin to take over, boom, you can very quickly regain control of your emotions. And again, that's when you're truly mighty, when you are in control of your emotions.
So if I could put you on the spot, I'm sure you're going to be able to handle this fastball question, but because since you wrote the book on it, is there any kind of a real life example that you can cite when some of these came into play?
Well, I tell a story early in the book of a time I was pulling into a hotel parking lot, and I was pulling into the parking space itself, and I really, Jim, wasn't paying attention as I should have, which I regret, and I nearly clipped a guy as he was getting out of his car, and he looked at me, right? You know, he reacted. Who could blame him, right? He almost got hit by somebody. And he looked at me and just shot me a nasty, horrible look. You know, it's that saying, if looks could kill, I'd be a dead man.
Yeah.
So, now, he reacted, obviously. Now, had I reacted to that reaction, then what would have happened? Well, I'd have said something back, and he'd have said something. We'd argued, and, at best, it would have been an uncomfortable situation. At worst, maybe not road rage, but parking lot rage. And, it just wouldn't have been a fun situation, certainly. So, but what I did instead is I responded, and I simply you know, smile. You know, I went into an immediate apologetic smile. I put my hand up in the air, you know, as to wave, and I mouthed the word through the window. I mouthed the words, "Sorry," and, you know, with a smile, with an apologetic smile. Well, immediately he went. He put his hand up and went, "No problem," you know. So again, had I bought into his reaction with a reaction, it wouldn't have been a good situation. But instead, I responded. And this is what we need to do. We need to make sure – see, we can't depend on the other person to understand this. We need to be the person who understands it and acts on it in a positive way.
That's awesome, and I'm so glad I recognized it was you, and the fact that you almost hit me, that was really a close call.
Yeah, I felt bad, Jim, and I just want to say sorry.
No way. Oh, man. All right, we're going to pause here for a very brief timeout, but on the other side, more great information with my special guest, Bob Book, and his book is called Adversaries into Allies, and we will be right back.
In the best-selling book, No BS Direct Marketing, legendary marketer Dan Kennedy said this: "My single biggest recommendation is the use of a monthly customer newsletter. Nothing, and I mean nothing, maintains your fence better." Dan is absolutely correct. The truth is, for just about any business owner, the greatest potential for new business and higher profits lies within its current customer base. Stronger customer relationships yield higher sales and more profits, and a monthly newsletter is the best relationship-building tool, bar none. Unfortunately, for many entrepreneurs, the struggle of producing a newsletter every month is too much, and it just doesn't get done. But no longer. Every month, No Hassle Newsletters members get 24 pages of Jim's famous customer-loving content and his amazing ready-to-go newsletter templates. Your company's No Hassle Newsletter will generate more repeat and referral business in less than 1 hour per month. Join the hundreds of entrepreneurs already using No Hassle Newsletters at www.nohasslenewsletters.com. That's www.nohasslenewsletters.com.
And we are back. Let's get right back to my very special guest, Mr. Bob Berg. He's the author of the brand new smash hit book, Adversaries into Allies. And Bob, you say there's one question you can ask that is pretty much guaranteed to keep a potential misunderstanding from ever actually taking place. Let's enlighten our audience with that one question.
Yeah, well, it has to do with understanding the clash of belief systems, and that is that different people see the world through a different lens, and they have different definitions for different words and different things and different ways of seeing different scenarios. So what you would do is the actual question itself, and we set up the question more tactfully than this, but the question itself is either how would you define and then the thing you're talking about, or what do you mean by? And what you would, let's say, for example, the person says, the boss comes out and says, we need to have this project completed soon. Now, one person on the team might look at soon as being tomorrow. One person might see it as being next week, and one person might see soon as being next month. We don't really know. And so what we might do is say, you know, Dave or Karen, you know, whoever the boss's name is, just for my own clarification, and that would be, that's what I call a buffer. That just makes it a little bit easier for them to take the question without feeling defensive in any way. You know, Dave, just for my own clarification, when you say soon, is there something, you know, is there a specific date you're thinking of? And that way the person's going to say, well, yes, you know, we need it by the end of this week, or we need it by Thursday at 5 o'clock. So what you've done is you've kept a potential misunderstanding from ever taking place because you've asked for them to basically define the term. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. And by the way, that also goes the other way, where if somebody says, I need that ASAP, and you're thinking an hour, and so you clarify, they go, oh, well, I'm going to be on the road the rest of this week. Just get it to me by next Wednesday. That'll be fine, you know. All of a sudden, you buy yourself an extra week. So it really has to go with, you know, some people just have a different interpretation of what quick, soon, or late, mm-hmm. whenever. You know what I mean? So it's a very good question. So just let's clarify that. Well, actually, I think I just did it. Let's clarify that one more time. So the actual question you ask is?
Yeah, it would either be, you know, how would you define something, or basically it's what do you mean by so-and-so, and you put a bit of a buffer or lead in before it, just so it's not, you know, saying, well, what do you mean by, or, How would you define, might come off, depending upon the relationship, might come off a little bit sharper or threatening. So what you just do is, just for my own clarification, or you can be self-deprecating in a way, just to make sure I don't mess, this up, or just to make sure we're all on the same page. When you say soon, are you, and then you could say, what exactly do you mean, or how would you define that, or is there a certain date you're thinking of?
You know what else, Bob? When you ask a follow-up question like that, it shows that you're listening, and that shows that you really care. It's pretty powerful.
That's true. Very true, yeah.
One of the most difficult things I think we do as human beings is to tell somebody no. I know I struggle with that sometimes. Our natural reaction, I think, is to want to help and say yes and do whatever we can. But especially, I think in the entrepreneurial world, we get stuck in doing so many things and therefore nothing gets done well. So, it is difficult. Why is that, and how do we overcome, why is it so hard to say no, and what suggestions do you have to do that?
Well, first, I think as entrepreneurs, we tend to be doers. We're always doing something. And to a lot of us, everything kind of looks good. but also, people know we're doers, and so they want us as part of what they're doing. And we're people pleasers, most of us. And so we want to say yes to people. We want to, especially if we're asked to do something that's certainly not outlandish, but it might not be something we want to do. And so we want to be able to say no, but we want to be able to say no in a way that respects the other person, that honors the other person, and at the same time respects and honors our own boundaries. Now, there are two basic ways that I notice people say no, Jim. And I don't believe either of these two are particularly productive. The first is, and this has become the politically correct thing over the last couple of years, and that is, people advise, just tell people no. Or, I've heard it said, no is a complete sentence. And, I cringe when I hear that, because I just picture, and people will kind of nod their heads like they're, empowered to do that. Okay, from now on, I'm just going to tell people no. And, I kind of want to say, really, are you really going to do that? Someone asks you to serve on a committee or something, let's say. And it's certainly not outlandish, it also isn't something you want to do. And my feeling is, if it's not something you want to do and there's really no compelling reason to do it, you probably shouldn't do it. Saying no to that which you should say no to allows you to say yes to what you should say yes to. So, but are you going to say to the person, no? Or, no, I don't want to, or, like that. No, of course not. First of all, it's just not nice. You're also making a potential adversary out of an ally, or out of a potential ally. You're closing yourself off to other opportunities with this person that may or may not be more appropriate for you to do. But most of all, by being rude like that, you're not acting congruently with your basic value system of treating people with respect. So I don't think saying no rudely is a good way to do it. The other thing people do, which is just as counterproductive, is they'll make an excuse. They'll say something like, well, I would, but I'm just too busy right now. Well, there are a couple of challenges with that. First of all, it's not that you're too busy. It's that you really just don't value doing the thing as much as you value not doing the thing. So if you really wanted to do it, you'd find a way. As entrepreneurs, we do that. We find ways to do the thing we really want to do. So it's sort of a fib, and when we fib, we don't feel good about ourselves. So it's kind of yucky. That's a technical term right there. I hope you don't mind.
Yucky, I like that. Yeah. You said a minute ago, allies into adversaries. I'm just going to let you know, I'm not suggesting that should be your next book. That's
right, exactly. Yes. I think that's a good career move right there to not title it that. And so the second thing, though, is when you make an excuse, that person is going to answer your objection. And when they persuasively communicate the fact that it's really not going to take much time, that time is not really an issue, and so forth, then you're faced with two choices. One, you either have to admit that you are fibbing because you really don't want to do it, so you're not going to feel good about yourself, and they're certainly not going to feel good about you. Or, in order to save face, you've got to then accept the gig, and do the thing you don't want to do, which really is just not benefiting anyone. So, fortunately, we don't have to be rude, and we don't have to to make excuses either. We can answer in such a way that it really is the most productive of all. And it's very, very simple. Practice it a couple of times, and for the rest of your life, you'll be able to do this. And it simply goes like this. When they ask you to serve on that committee or ask you to do the thing or whatever, you simply say, "Thank you so much. While it's not something I want to do, please know how honored I am to be asked." Now, the wording can be a little bit different depending upon your style. It could be, "Oh, thank you. While it's not something I'd like to do, or while it's not something I choose to do, please know how honored I am to be asked." That's it. You've thanked the person. You were as polite as could be. You let them know you were honored to be asked. It's just not something that you choose to do or want to do. And you didn't give an excuse for them to hang on to. So it's the most effective way to be able to say no in a way that they can't resent you for it, and you can be very comfortable with it. Now, if they come back one time, as they might, especially if they're used to you giving in on things, and they try to pressure you and say, "Oh, come on, but we really, really need you to do this," and so forth and so on, you simply say, "Oh, thank you so much. I'd rather not, but again, I'm so honored to be asked." Just do that with no emotion, with no defensiveness. And I'll tell you, from that point on, they know that they can always ask you, and that's fine, but that when you say no, it's no, and that's the end of the story.
Yeah, and you get a lot more respect that way, too.
Yes,
I mean,
instead
of being wishy-washy, like, "Oh, let me think about it." I mean, if you're not going to do it, just let them know you're not going to do it so they can move on.
Right, and Jim, I often, and I'm sure the same with you and many of us listening, get asked to do certain things, a lot of times by email. And I basically do the same thing on email. And I can't tell you how many times I will get an email back in response thanking me for my honesty and for my tactful way of doing it. So, this is not just philosophy here. These are all things within this book, throughout the entire book. I'm sharing information that absolutely works.
And it builds relationships, which is a very good thing. You know, you're such a skilled communicator. Let me give you a real-world example. Let's say that you want to buy a product, but maybe it's a little overpriced or outside of your budget. How do you communicate this to, let's say, an aggressive salesperson or maybe not an aggressive salesperson, just to keep the relationship going so you can, just keep in the conversation?
Mm-hmm. Well, and whether they're aggressive or not, you need to make sure you're the one that sets the frame or resets the frame by answering calmly, non-emotionally, other than with friendliness, but non-defensively, I should say, so that you're the calming influence and they understand this is how they need to work with you if they're going to work with you. But what you would say in this case is, "Dave, thank you so much. As much as I enjoy the idea of owning this from you, at this particular price, it's not something I feel I can justify doing. I wouldn't say I can't afford it. It's none of their beeswax whether you can afford it or not. It's that at this point, what you're saying is that the value you place on it is less than what they're asking for in price. But again, you're doing it with respect. "Dave, thank you so much. As much as I enjoy the idea," or anywhere you can say, "As much as I appreciate all the time you've taken to explain this to me or to show me this model or product or what have you, at this point," or you could say, "At this point," or "At that delivery date," or whatever it is that you have the challenge with, "I just don't feel I can't justify making the decision to own," or "I can't
justify the decision to own.
The key phrase is, "I can't justify," because here's what you're doing. "I can't justify" is an I message. It's putting the onus on you as opposed to telling him, "Oh, you're doing this," or "You're charging too high." It's "I can't justify." And again, justify is very impersonal. It's not a judgment. It's simply a fact. "I can't justify." And so then here's what happens. So then pause and don't say anything and let him or her come back and say, "Well, what price would you need it to be?" And then you can give the price that you feel is more appropriate. Now, if they don't come back with something, and this is something you really don't want to walk away from, but would like to give this a shot at getting a lower price with it, what you do is you say, "Dave, is there another price you could offer, or is there a better price you could offer?" And then just pause and let him answer. If there is, he probably will come back with something. Sometimes he can't. It really isn't something that's in his control to do. And then, of course, there's other ways. If you can figure out another win-win way to make it worth his or her while, that's fine too. But let's, again, assuming that price is the only thing right here, you would start with, you know, thanking them while I, you know, appreciate your time, while I love the idea of doing business with you or owning this product. At this particular price, I just can't justify taking ownership. And then, boom, see if he comes back with something. If he doesn't and you really want this, you say, I'm just wondering, is there a better price you could offer? Boom.
And that's awesome.
Then it's in his hands.
Very powerful. So I really have one more question, but I actually just wrote one that I want to ask you. It's kind of a big one. You know, can utilizing tact and maybe empathy, can that really get you out of a traffic ticket? Something we've all had the unfortunate situation to be in.
Yeah, actually, it can. I can tell you from personal experience and from the many people who've utilized this teaching. And let's walk through an example. And by the way, here's when it absolutely won't work. If you're really driving recklessly, driving to endanger, or going way over the speed limit, or intoxicated, no, it's not going to work, nor should it. But let's say you didn't come to that totally complete stop, or you're going a little heavy on the pedal. So it's not public enemy crime number one, but it's still ticket worthy, if you will. And so what happens is when you see the flashing blues in the mirror or you hear the siren, pull over, obviously, as soon as it's safe and bring the car to a complete stop, turn off the engine. Now, if it's at night, turn the inside light on and put your hands on the 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock positions of the wheel and stay perfectly still as the police officer approaches the vehicle. Why? Because what you've done is you've communicated your empathy for him or her, for their situation, that while they're out there protecting the public, you understand that the most dangerous time on their job is when they're approaching the driver's side of a vehicle they've just stopped. So you're letting them know you respect that, you empathize with that. Now, when they say, good evening or whatever, you simply say good evening, officer, and you're very polite. Now, when they say, do you realize you are going X miles an hour in a, 50 mile per hour zone or something like that, you simply say, yes, I do realize that and I apologize. Or, if this is true, you might say, I didn't realize it until I heard your siren. I looked down immediately and absolutely I was going that speed. Now, what you've done is you've, again, separated yourself from pretty much everyone else they pull over who has some kind of excuse, and they've heard them all and they don't believe them. So they see you really as as someone totally different. You empathize, you're respectful, and you told them the truth. Now, that will often be enough right there, but if you feel you need to take it a little bit deeper, you can say, officer, again, absolutely no excuses. I was going that speed. This isn't something I usually do, and I'm wondering if it would be appropriate if I could possibly get off with a warning this time. Now, again, because of the way you've asked the question, the way you phrased it and framed it, there's a good chance that's going to happen. But in case you feel, while he or she is thinking about it for a second, if you feel you need to do this, you can use what I call the 8 keywords that will practically always move a person to your side of the issue, providing you've set it up correctly through politeness and patience. And that is to say, if you can't do it, I'll definitely understand. If you can't do it, I'll definitely understand. Because what you've done is you've just given him or her the out or back door. And typically people are much more resistant when they feel they're being forced or coerced. But when you give them a back door, an escape route, they desire to take it less. I call it Berg's Law of the out or back door, which simply says the bigger the out or back door you give someone to take, the less they'll feel the need to take it.
If we're doing a video interview right now, you and everybody else would see me with this smile on my face, because I've known you a long time, and I'm kind of in awe right now. I asked you kind of an off-the-cuff, silly question, and you just gave the most amazing answer, which everybody's going to remember now. That's going to be the hit of this interview right there.
Oh, you wouldn't believe how many emails I get, Jim, from people
who
tell me that I just saved them X amount of dollars from a traffic ticket, a speeding ticket, or what have you. Yeah, it absolutely – now, does it work every time? No, of course not. It works most of the time.
That's awesome. So let me ask you my last question. Let's talk about politics, or not talk about politics, but politics. You know, it's a very fiery subject, just like religion. And, you know, and we seem to be in a situation, I think, in the last few years where friendships are actually being destroyed. Families, you know. Truth be told, I can't talk about politics with one or two members of my family because it instantly gets so heated. And I don't know whatever happened to, you know, discourse, but and especially on social media, Bob, when I see people post something, and next thing you know, there's 200 comments and people are feuding. I that's why I never go there. I mean, I want to be known as sharing information, maybe a little humor, and just, you know, being a fun place to visit, not someplace you're going to go have a war on Facebook. But, hey, you know, how do you persuade someone to your side of an issue politically without turning them off? I mean, is that that's got to be just a huge job these days. I mean, I guess that would be the ultimate adversary into ally.
Yeah, and first of all, it's important to understand why the situation is as it is. And you made mention when you talked about religion, politics is sort of like a religion in a sense. People very, very closely identify with their politics, just like they do with their religion. And, you know, nobody wants to be told your religion is wrong, and few people want to be told that their politics is wrong. Now, add to this that because of social media, there's much more of an avenue for people to express themselves and their political opinions. And one thing about social media is while you're interacting with people, you're really protected by the safety of a computer in front of you. So there's really no danger in being rude. You know what I'm saying? So you put all these things together, and it makes up the human element, and this really causes some firestorms and a lot of ad hominem attacks, which are simply attacks against the person rather than, you know, their political beliefs. And so the first thing I think we want to do is cut the ad hominem attacks. Stop attacking the person. Understand that even if they are on the opposite end of the political spectrum that you are in, that you are on, they probably have, and I'm not talking about the small percentage of people who really do just have bad, you know, desires for people. I'm talking about people who, you know, basically are good people, and they want what's best for the country. They want what's best for the individuals in this country, but they have a different way of believing that's going to happen, okay? And so the first thing that we can do is understand they're a human being who basically wants the same end result, a prosperous society, one in which people don't have to needlessly suffer, one in which people are generally happy, and it, you know what I'm saying? And so it's a different way of going about it. So let's say that there's somebody that there's a that there's a political discussion going on that you do want to be involved with. The first thing to do is, you know, is to let that person know that, you know, while obviously we disagree on how to get to a certain point, I think we both want what is best for, you know, the country in general and for the individuals. And this is where we utilize something called the Ranzberger pivot, which I learned years ago. It was devised by Marshall Fritz and Ray Ranzberger. And it was a way of having a political discussion with someone, being persuasive by first finding that one area where you know you both agree with, and then pivoting into the idea that you want to put across in an educational way. So let's, for instance, take the Social Security system, okay? And you've got one person who believes that, you know, government should be in charge of people's retirement, that government knows best what to do, that people aren't, you know, qualified or shouldn't have that responsibility themselves, and so forth and so on. Let's just say you believe, and I don't know this, I'm just using this as an example. Let's say you believe that the individual should be in charge of their own retirement, that they should take that kind of responsibility, that they can do it better than government can, and that, you know, when it comes down to it, it's the right thing to do as opposed to the current system as it is. Now, this person says to you, well, Jim, people like you who think it should be privatized, and people like you are heartless. What's going to happen? You don't care about elderly people, you know, having to eat cat food. People like you just don't. Right, okay, so what's that? That's an ad hominem attack. They're attacking you as a human being. By the way, have you ever noticed that when someone attacks another person for their political views, they say, you know, you're a scum of the earth, you're trying to ruin this country. The person generally doesn't respond by saying, you know, I'd never thought of it that way before. You're right. I think I'm going to take your point of view now. It just doesn't happen. You know, the opposite is going to happen. That person is going to be much more positional at this point and want to defend their position. So this person has just attacked you for being heartless and not caring about the elderly and, you know, and so forth and so on. So instead of you reacting and coming back with something like, well, people like you don't even think. I mean, how can you do this? They've shown that they take this money. It's a pay-as-you-go Ponzi scheme. They take the money. They spend it on other things. It's functionally bankrupt. The lockbox is baloney, and it's unconstitutional, and it hurts the poor more than anybody, and blah, 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 and you go on and on. And this person isn't listening. This person isn't reading any of that. It's going totally, totally past them, as would be expected. So how about instead, if you find a point of agreement and you say something like, well, I appreciate your passion for the issue, like, and here is the key phrase, like you, I want to live in a society where no one who is elderly ever has to worry about going hungry and never has to worry about being a burden on society or their family. I think our main point of disagreement is the correct way to ensure that happens. Boom. Now you've taken, because now this person knows you're not attacking them. They know that basically you agree with what they believe. You know, that's exactly what you believe. You want to, that's what they want too. They want a person to not have to worry about going hungry and not being a burden on society or their families and so forth. So they have good intent. And so once we do that, then the pivot is now getting into how and why. You know, what we found is that blah, 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 and now you can make your points in a way that this person – now, don't get me wrong. They're not going to all of a sudden change their mind during the initial conversation, but here's what will happen. They'll now be open to further discussion. You can plant certain seeds and continue at another time, but here's the other thing. The people who are looking in on this conversation and not commenting, they're looking to see what each of you are going to say. And when that person's only logic, quote unquote, is that you're some heartless, you know, whatever, who doesn't care, but then you come back with a very kind and tactful statement, and then you come with some logic that is politely stated and powerful, it's those people who are going to be more apt to be open to that idea.
That's awesome. Oh, that's a good one. There's a whole seminar right there in that answer.
Thank you.
So we've actually gone a little long just because it's such an amazing interview. But, Bob, how can people learn more about you, connect with you, and most importantly, get a hold of your most excellent books?
Well, thank you. Really, everything's right at the website, which is burg.com. And while they're there, if they'd like to read Chapter 1 of Adversaries and Two Allies, they can just click on the graphic, and that will take them to the page where they can get Chapter 1. And while they're at the site, they can connect with me on the various social media and check out my blog and whatever they'd like. But we do invite them to come to burg.com and hang out for a while and have some fun.
Is that the longest URL you could find? URG, that's pretty good.
Yeah, I really worked hard at that one. I knew nothing about the internet at the time, and somebody said, Bob, just to give you a hint on something, get this thing called burg.com. I said, why? They said, just get it. He'll be glad you did.
Oh, that's a great story in itself. Well, man, you're a great friend, and you're just such a gifted communicator, and we just thank you so much for spending time with this group of entrepreneurs today. Thank you so much, Bob.
Thank you, Jim. And, hey, I've enjoyed watching you with your co-host lately, Mr. Nathan Rhodes.
Nathan Palmer Rhodes, NPR. Nathan's a big hit, and I can't wait. It's been a couple of weeks since I've seen him, so we're probably due to head up there to New England and travel that lovely stretch of I-95.
Well, tell him and Jessica, his awesome mom, that Uncle Bob says hi.
I will certainly do that. All right, that wraps up this very special episode of Stick Like Glue Radio with Bob Berg. And Stick Like Glue Radio is the only podcast dedicated to helping you create an everlasting bond with your customers, again, so they stay longer, spend more, and refer more. I am your host, Jim Palmer, and I'm committed to helping you build a more profitable business faster. Watch for another great episode of Stick Like Glue Radio next week. And until then, keep taking action, keep moving forward, and don't ever, ever give up. Hey, now go out there and do something nice for somebody. Take care, everybody.
You've been listening to Stick Like Glue Radio, the only podcast dedicated to helping you create an everlasting bond with your customers so they stay longer, spend more, and refer more. Stick Like Glue Radio features Jim Palmer's unique brand of smart marketing and business building advice for action-oriented entrepreneurs. To make sure you don't miss a single profit-boosting show, subscribe to this podcast at www.getjimpalmer.com. If you know other entrepreneurs looking for the fastest way to higher profits in their business, please tell them about the Stick Like Glue Radio podcast. Now go and implement what you've learned and boost your profits. See you next week for more Stick Like Glue Radio.